Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I'm joined by Sam and James tonight, and we're going to be discussing Powers of X 1 through 6. Sam, how you doing tonight?
I am well, John. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. James, how about you?
Doing well, too.
This is, I'm going to say, is a huge, giant crossover for the Back Issue Spotlight. You know, both you guys on at once. It'll be fun.
Yeah.
Now, I had originally read House of X, Powers of X, when they were coming out. We did, I think, both Powers of X 1 and 6 as part of the Weekly Comic Spotlight. Is that right, James?
I believe so. I remember doing it, and it was a lot of fun, I remember.
This time when I read through it, of course, we did House of X last week, so I read just that, and then this time I read just Powers of X. And this, of course, has four sort of intertwined stories of the X to the zero power kind of happening at the year one point of the X-Men, X to the first power, or 10 to the first power at the 10-year point, which is present day, and then, you know, 100 years after the start of the X-Men, so 90 years in the future, and then, you know, X to the third, you know, 1,000 years out, or, you know, minus the 10 for present day or whatever. And, of course, they bounce between the different storylines throughout the whole thing. How did that aspect work for you guys?
For me, I particularly do not like that type of storytelling because especially when I was reading it in single issues when it was coming out, it makes it a little bit confusing and difficult to keep track of what's what, even though they give you a little blurb, you know, beforehand, this is year, whatever. I like one contiguous story. It makes it a little easier to digest.
I'm very similar. That said, I didn't read it till the collections kind of came out, and I read them kind of in that reading order. So it was, for the most part, one house, one powers, where a few times they switch flopped and you got two in a row. So at least I was able to kind of do it in one or two sittings, so it wasn't that bad. But yeah, keeping track of really five separate stories all at the same time isn't the simplest thing to do.
Definitely.
And you're counting kind of house as that fifth?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair, because while it takes place concurrently with the X to the first or whatever, what's going on here, what's going on there, because even within each of those four time frames in this, it bounces around a bit.
Quite a bit. And at times I would be a little bit confused and I'd be like, oh yeah, okay, here's what's going on. But yeah, that happened to me quite a bit. And I just don't care for that type of storytelling, even though it's done a lot in comics today.
I am curious how this would have worked for me if it had been kind of remastered into chronological order. In other words, all the X to the zero at once, then all the X to the first, then all the X to the second, and then all X to the third.
I would have enjoyed it.
Well, I'm not normally a fan of doing that. Boy, how do I put this? I do think writers use this hopping around in time thing as a major crutch.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, if it's a story that's kind of dependent on it, like, there are people that have gone and, like, reverse-engineered, like, the film Memento and put it in the correct order. And it's okay. It's not the film Christopher Nolan envisioned. And I have a feeling this one would be kind of similar.
Well, it comes down to, is it the story or the storytelling that's kind of the hook? And for something like Memento, it's the storytelling. Because, I mean, that whole thing hinges on kind of almost telling the story backwards.
Yes.
And this one, I don't know if it's a storytelling. I think it's the story itself that's the hook. It's because you're basically rebuilding and resetting the entire X franchise going forward.
I think the reason they couldn't do kind of the chronological approach is because they were serializing it across six issues.
Yeah.
And while we get most of these, actually, we don't get all of these time frames in every issue.
Correct.
It would have been really weird because I don't know what the page count is for, you know, the 1 year point versus the 10 year point versus the 100 versus the 1,000. But I think we would have gotten shorter stuff, particularly for the 1,000 years out, and it would not have been a satisfying conclusion to the story, which is of course why they kind of bounced it all around the way they did.
Yeah. And the longer I read it, the more it made sense to, you know, like there was a few times where I'd be like a little bit, okay, what's going on here? But you pick up on it really quick. And I do remember because of the time jumping aspect and the storytelling and powers, I think that's the reason why I liked House a little bit more.
I can understand that. And there's also not just the jumping between the four time frames and even some flashbacks or whatever, but the other time jumping we get here is, again, they reveal originally, well, I'm trying to think if it was originally in House or if it was here, but I think it was House, that Moira is living multiple times.
Yes.
So we bounce between her lives within this.
Which is why I think the storytelling is part of the hook.
I definitely think it's part of the hook, but I don't think it's the main hook. I think that if you had almost jettisoned most of the future stuff, the 100,000-year-out stuff, it still covers most of what needs to happen for kind of the House of X, Powers of X relaunch.
I agree for the relaunch. That said, as someone who hasn't read the X-Men in about 20 years, I really enjoyed particularly the 100-year-out story. And eventually when you get to Sinister and issues 4 and 5 and knowing kind of where that's going, I think helps.
Well, it's funny because I never really connected with the characters from the 100 years out or the 1,000 years out. With the 1,000 years out, with the exception of the couple that were, you know, known characters.
That's the same way I felt. And I think that happens quite a bit when they writers go too far out into the future and try to create these new characters and attachment. They bring, you know, build some commonalities to our current characters. More times than not, it seems to fail. Like 2099, there was a few characters that came out were cool, but most of them were kind of forgotten, you know, in time. And kind of like Future State, that's happening a little bit right now. You know, I don't feel as connected to the characters as I do the current DC characters.
Well, I think part of it with this, and I think it applies to Future State too, is when we get to that future point, it's hard in the space allotted to get enough context for these characters and their status quo to care that much about them.
Yeah, very limited. Very, very limited.
And here, particularly with the 100 years out, we get one that's, well, that's the red version of Nightcrawler for that day and age. Not the same character exactly, but we wind up, at least I did, with this kind of shorthand of, oh, it's this kind of character.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking.
And it never, those characters never really got past that point. And I think the fact that they were genetic mixes from Sinister and stuff, or through his handiwork, whether it was him specifically at that point in time or not, I don't know. That lends itself to, again, that kind of shorthand or whatever.
I agree. Now, one thing that's kind of interesting, you know, it seems like when you go into this future storytelling, they're kind of going with this AI, or, you know, it's going to destroy humanity, destroy mutant kind. Kind of like Stephen Hawking always said, AI will destroy humanity. But do either one of you guys play video games? I don't know if you guys do or don't. Or
a little, but very little.
Back in the day, I used to play Halo a lot, and they had the character in there, the librarian, the little robot in the background. It looked just like the character from Halo. We would follow you around in certain missions, so it was just hilarious. Every time I see this, I think of Halo.
Are you thinking the Nimrod character?
Not the Nimrod. It's like the little intelligence, the little robot that followed people around.
Okay.
Yeah. The one that's like Nimrod's assistant, because that's not right. You've got her as well, but yes.
Yeah, I was just
like
laughing.
Like the scribe.
Yep, definitely.
That being said, and again, as someone who's not as connected to current X-Men, or at least immediately before this X-Men, I agree with you on the characters that are the derivative, you know, soups of existing characters. I actually really like Nimrod and connected with that character.
Oh, cool.
Well, I thought it was cool to use him because he's a character from way back in the day.
Yes, he is.
He was in the, I want to say, around the 180 point, give or take, you know, 20 issues or something. I don't remember exactly when he's from. But kind of that, again, future state sentinel kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So if you're going to go with the X-Men, you're going to go to the future, he's an obvious character to bring in.
I agree.
Actually a little funny with this that we never got much of Cable or any of his kind of group of characters.
I was surprised with that too, and I can't remember if there's anything particular going on with Cable at this time, because later on there was a Cable series that we were reading. But something happened with Cable and the aging thing, and I don't want to spoil it for anyone who hasn't been reading the comic, and maybe that's why he wasn't available, but he should have been available because of the stuff in this comic. I'm trying to be veiled there to not spoil what happened.
If not him, there's Bishop and a few other characters from future time points that they could have brought in.
Yeah, it's very surprising. The people who jump through time, you didn't see them at all in this, which you would expect them to be aware of it, cognizant, or have some kind of impact.
I think the 100 years out would have had a lot more impact for me if, in addition to the mutants versus humans stuff, there was almost the pure mutant versus the mix, you know, genetic mix mutant kind of a thing.
Yeah. Now, one thing, I know you guys both noticed this, that this did deal with later on. They're talking about the six, you know, life of Moira, which was kind of passed over in House of X. We're like, why is that missing? Do you think we'll see these characters in the future in the X-Men, any of the X-Books, or do you think this is just here and the future that we won't see?
That was one of the other things that I was going to ask you guys at some point is kind of that same thing, because at this point, we're, what, year or two into the, 2 years, I guess, into the Dawn of X, or, you know, post House of X, Powers of X, and I have yet to see any ramifications at all from the 100 and 1,000 year out storylines in Powers.
Me neither. And I know you're not reading them, Sam, but yeah, they haven't been referenced at all, and I've been reading all the X books, but I feel like there was so much lore built here and so much time was dedicated to this that I almost feel like it's a little bit of a miss if we don't see more of this in the future, but who knows?
Well, and there's an aspect, well, that stuff hasn't happened yet, how could it have ramifications? But we are living in a world and with a group that time travel's kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Again, I do think part of that for you gentlemen might be the closer connection, because I have continued. I've read most of the ones and a few of the twos so far.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'm not giving up. I'm not current, but I'm getting there.
Oh, cool.
Again, as someone who stepped away for 20 years, I agree with you, John, on the Cable and Bishop thing. But other than that, but with Scott as he is, and Cable and Bishop not being the same characters I remember, I just kind of accept the fact that they don't exist anymore or haven't existed much here is a little odd, but...
They just seem like one of many characters they could have brought in the 100 years out thing, in addition to these new kind of mashup characters, having a few others that we know from different points in time, I thought would have been interesting, and it would have grounded those characters a little bit.
I agree.
So, I mean, I didn't dislike the 100 years out and the 1,000 years out, but both of them seemed to hit a point where they, well, like, the 100 years out really gets, I think, the majority, if not all, of issue number 3.
Yeah.
But then it's done.
Exactly. It's gone. And so... I won't say it was my favorite part, but I feel like it wasn't my favorite because I didn't get to see enough of it. And maybe if I saw more of it and cared more about the characters, it might end up being one of my favorite parts. Who knows?
Well, yeah, we didn't have the time to really get to know these characters.
Yeah, and it's just because we're building this world, building this lore, this mythology. He's coming out with his, basically, the source book for the X universe. You know, henceforth, this is what will be happening. But, you know, there's so much he put into this. I want to see how long he's going to have to play with these toys and get to where he's going. Because it seems like maybe 5 and 6 years isn't even enough time at the pace he's been going.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious how long of a game plan he's got for all of this stuff. Because, I mean, as James and I talked about last week, he's clearly got a game plan.
Oh, yeah. Now, did you like that? How they were showing in here? What's interesting about going back and reading this is I see stuff that was seeded in these stories that came to fruition. So I know there is a game plan. And that's where I was like, he didn't just come up with the stuff. He's actually planning ahead and gaming ahead. And so, like, we saw the hints for X of Swords with the cards and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of appreciate that that was tossed out there then. And then it made me look differently at some of the things that are in here and go, okay, this may actually be the end game, and he's showing us where he's going, but we don't know it till we see it.
Yeah, I think there was a text page about Sinister and stuff in issue one that may have some clues about the end game.
Yep.
And it was in issue four, I think it was, with the present day stuff that really set up a lot of the X of Swords stuff that played out again more recently. So it's funny because he's doing a great job of planting seeds and then paying off later. Yet there are also a number of places, particularly in the year one part of this, where he's doing some fairly significant retcons.
Yeah, I agree.
And I don't really have any problem with that because he's doing it fairly well. The only thing that really kind of stood out and I took notice of was in the first issue, we get Moira kind of revealing herself to Charles back, you know, when they first meet or whatever, which we saw in House of X number 2. But that was by the other artist, even though it's the same couple of pages, just drawn. The line works subtly different.
Exactly. But then
we see those exact pages from issue 1 of Powers of X in, I think it was issue 6 of Powers of X. And not just, oh, it's similar, whatever. I mean, as near as I can tell, they're exactly the same pages. I mean, line work, everything. And it's like, what, 5-6 pages, maybe more?
Yeah, copy and paste it. That was kind of interesting. I was like, huh. I don't know if I like that, but it made sense. But at the same time, it seemed that like maybe they could have put some more narrative in there instead of just copying and pasting the scene over.
The problem I had with that is they copied and pasted the scene, then they cut to the 1,000 years out. And then when they cut back, it's picking up with what Charles had read.
Yeah.
And when I was first reading that scene and we're cutting away from it, I'm like, I've seen this before and you didn't add anything.
Yeah.
But it's to take, you know, into account that when we would have seen it before would have been, you know, 6-12 issues, if you're counting House as well, earlier. So they kind of had to refresh our memory on that, but did they need to take so many pages to do it?
I think that was wasted space, personally.
It's an art to foreshadowing. I didn't mind it as much as you gentlemen, obviously. As far as the retconning goes, again, as someone who's coming back, it's hard to tell what this is retconning and what in this is just dealing with things that have already previously changed.
Well, when in the Zero, or the X of Zero, you know, the year one part of it, Charles is tasking people with various things.
Mm-hmm.
I saw almost all of that as a retcon. There was no sign that Cerebro, you know, was able to back up mutants and stuff prior to House of X, Powers of X. Here he is kind of retroactively planting the seed of how that came to be.
Got it. Okay.
And again, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but to make stuff happen in the present day, he had to go back to the early point in the X-Men stuff and change a few things.
Yeah. And again, as someone who's been out for a while, I just kind of looked at this as a clean slate and went, whatever. You know, if there's things similar to what I remember, great. If there's not, okay. And just kind of accept it. You know, to me, someone who's been away for a long time, and again, this may...
Yeah.
Charles just seems like a completely different person.
In this timeline, he is. He has given up the dream and is taking a fundamentally different approach to mutant-human relationships.
Yeah, and it's not just this timeline. Let me rephrase that. It's not just the 100 or the 1,000 years. The current day Charles is different. And in many ways, even the zero-year Charles is very different than the one I kind of remember.
Absolutely. And when I say timeline, I was thinking in terms of Moira's 10th life.
Fair enough. Okay.
So I think what we had been kind of used to prior to this would have been from either her original or one of the previous ones. I'd have to go look at the chart to figure out which timeline made the most sense. But yeah, this Charles, and again, to me, that's part of what Hickman has retconned here. Is when Charles sees all of this stuff from all of her lifetimes, including the one that goes the 1,000 years out, he's like, the path I was on is not going to work. I mean, he's seen it, you know, X number of times not working. Let's chart a new path. Let's do something radically different.
Yeah. I think he's finally come to the realization, well, and they flat out said it in the book, we always fail. Mutants will always fail unless we change the status quo. And that's mm-hmm. what brings them all together. And Charles has to say, let's give up the dream and we need to take care of ourselves. We're in it for us.
Well, that seemed to be the entire point of the 100 years out and the 1,000 years out timelines and story arcs or whatever, is that it ends poorly for the mutants.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to win. And I think to a degree that was needed to allow the radical changes that the X-Men have undergone in these issues.
Yeah.
And that being said, I was never a big fan of Charles. I really dislike this.
Oh, okay. You dislike him even more.
Yes.
How come and what changed about him to make him more dislikable to you? And what was the seed of your original dislike prior to that?
He always just seemed kind of aloof and a little bit of a dreamer. So I didn't dislike him. I just didn't particularly care for him. He seemed slightly less than human in the past.
Definitely a bit remote, and definitely that dreamer aspect I'll get.
This one, and this is obviously slightly a personal thing, totalitarianism scares the heck out of me just generally in life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This Charles is a totalitarian. No doubt about it.
Yeah, given how mutants were feared before, going down this path, not going to make them feared any less. It's going to amp it up quite a bit.
Yeah, it almost seems like this would instigate the war sooner.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is weird because they're trying to come together to go on a different path. Not saying go on a different path, but maybe they want the confrontation sooner before mankind can get the AI up and running. That's the goal. Take them out before we do.
They definitely do, because wasn't that the point of the 1,000 years out?
Yep.
Is humanity had bought the time to genetically engineer themselves to be able to compete.
Exactly. And it's also the point of House of X. They have the raid on the Mother Mold.
Yep. Yep.
You got to take it out now.
Well, and but ultimately, this Charles is no different than Magneto's always been. And my entire life, Magneto was the bad guy.
Yeah.
Yes, him and Charles had been friends, but ultimately, that was the bad guy. And now Charles and Magneto are the same guy.
When did you stop reading?
Right 5 or 10 issues into Morrison's run.
So you'd gone through the entire point where Magneto was running the New Mutants and the school and all that stuff.
Yep.
So some of the points where he was, I don't want to say a hero, but less villainous and more on the hero's side.
And he had softened.
Yeah.
That Magneto was very different than the one from the, you know, mid-80s.
Uh-huh.
You know, the one from the mid-80s was closer to Apocalypse.
Yeah.
Yeah, but your point that the difference between Charles and Eric at this point is minimal at best.
Yeah, exactly.
If anything, Magneto is just more open about who he is, and the professor is... frankly, he's doing a lot of the same stuff, but I don't know that he realizes he's always doing that.
Yeah, maybe that is it. I don't know. And again, I don't dislike the stories. And like I said, it's not like Charles was one of my favorite characters to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But minus a few, most of these characters aren't likable.
Well, I think one of the other key differences with Charles that came out at the end is they flat out lied to Mystique about bringing back Destiny.
Yes.
That was surprising to me.
And there's a very clear no precogs are allowed on Krakoa.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder if they encounter a new mutant who has precognitive abilities, what are they going to do? You know, and that to me clearly is part of Hickman's endgame in some way, shape, or form.
I think that comes down to that totalitarian thing. You take them out. And I think they would at this point. They can't let them survive in this society.
I think that's how it's set up to be, but the question is, how do they do it without running afoul of the other mutants who are like, you know, we really shouldn't be killing off mutants left, right, and center. You know, if a precog comes, it's not like they can just, you know, execute them on sight. They've got to get them out of the way somehow without kind of getting caught.
Without them recognizing that they're taking them out, taking that person out.
Yeah.
Which has got to be hard to do.
Because you've got to imagine the standard X-Men, Cyclops, Jean Grey, Storm, etc. wouldn't have, you know, wouldn't be okay with, oh, you've just executed this guy because he happened to be able to see the future.
Yeah. And again, if that's where he's going, I'm interested and I'll hang around for the ride because, you know, now you're treading on one of my personal favorite sci-fi stories of all time in Philip Dick's Minority Report.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That was a great movie. Loved it.
The movie's good. The story's short and novella is really phenomenal.
Well, to me, it kind of is setting up that the pendulum after Hickman's run is going to swing back the other way. We're going to get a Charles that's more what we're used to from the past, and maybe even a more extreme pacifist or whatever because of the mistakes he presumably is going to end up making in this run at some point.
Yeah, that's possible too.
Yeah. And that'll depend on what the next writer wants to do and when they want to reset when they want to reset everything, because it obviously is going to head back that direction, I would think, at some point.
This definitely strikes me as a story, particularly with the multiple times of lives of Moira and stuff, that the end game is going to be the start of her 11th life, and she's going to wake up in the world that is whatever that next creative team wants, or their editors at least.
Yeah, and that'll be a big event.
Yeah.
Yeah, because at that point, you're almost setting up something like, oh, what was the big DC event? I can't remember, where everything was reset. Wolf.
Crisis on Infinite Earths?
Crisis on Infinite Earths, yeah. It's basically that level. Boom, everything's reset.
Well, what's interesting is I feel that House of X, Powers of X kind of sort of did that level of reset for the X-Men while doing it kind of in continuity. It's not like they rebooted the universe, but they kind of sort of rebooted a number of the characters. Again, Charles being the most extreme of them, shy of Moira.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just... Now, one thing I wanted to ask Sam particularly, because she had been out of, you know, reading the X books for several years, do you feel like this was a good jumping on point for you? Because I think this is a really great jumping on point personally, but I don't know, having read this for a while now.
The simple answer is yes. I've enjoyed it. I'm enjoying it. I'm continuing to enjoy it. I'm still moving forward. I think it's fine. I don't know how much of my previous experience is so I don't know if it's a good jumping on point for someone with a blank slate. It's certainly, I would say, a good coming back place for the old Claremont fans, if you're willing to accept it's just different.
Okay, cool.
Well, and I think you've got to go into this level of a retooling of a franchise with the expectation things are going to be different. Because if it was going great before, they wouldn't have needed to retool it. You know, if they need to retool it, they're going to change stuff. I am curious if any of our listeners had, like, never read the X-Men and started with House of X, Powers of X, and how accessible they found it. Because there's a ton of characters in play here.
Speaking of accessible, did you guys go back through and decode all this stuff? Or, I know I did not.
The Krakoa stuff?
Yes.
No, never. I gave up on that.
I did like the first one or two, and I went, this is just issue numbers, and like, and I'm like, okay, this is pointless. But then when you get to like the full text pages, I keep thinking there's probably something in there, but I don't have the energy or the desire to do that.
Yeah, John was going to build us a tool, right, where we scan it on our phones, and it tells us what it says, right, John?
I told you if I had nothing better to do, I might write a Python app that would do it, but I'd have to go figure out how to do the optical recognition and all that, and have been way, way too uninspired to do that. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody's written something like that out there where you could just basically, you know, scan the page in, run it through the app, and it would translate it for you.
Please, somebody.
I haven't bothered to look, but my guess is there's probably some website somewhere where somebody's got all the translations. But again, I don't feel like I missed enough to be interested enough to go search that out.
Yeah, me too. I just kind of go with it.
I know there's a Google app that'll do translation, you know, with the camera and stuff on a cell phone. It wouldn't amaze me if somebody had put Krakoa in there.
Yeah.
I haven't bothered to look, but...
Well, later on, the thing that comes out after this is... Apocalypse changes his name, and that just made me laugh a little bit. I don't know how to say his name. It's just a Krakoan symbol.
I thought that was a little over the top.
Yeah. Because I see that. I still call him Apocalypse, so whatever.
The mutant formerly known as Apocalypse. Come on, real people have done this.
Yeah. Now, there were some things that were interesting in those Hickmanisms, though, that I liked. He you know how he keeps on going with the powers, you know? You have, like, you know, this level of intelligence, you know, how the intelligence gets to a Titan and then it gets to this and that and whatever. But they always had those two things in the Marvel Universe that could stand out against the ultimate AI intelligence. And that was, what was it? It was the Phoenix Force. And then also, Who's the guy from Fantastic Four? The big guy, purple guy.
Galactus.
Galactus. Thank you. My brain doesn't work sometimes. But Galactus and the Phoenix Force are the counterbalance to that. So if we ever do see that, I would like to see that happen. That showdown.
Okay. I'd be surprised if they pulled either in, but the Phoenix Force, obviously with the X-Men, makes total sense to bring in.
It does.
And it's actually a little surprising that we didn't really see any hide or hair of in the future timelines for this.
I agree. And I don't think he put it in there for no reason. So I'm hoping we get a flash of the Phoenix right now. We're getting it over in the Avengers where I don't want to see it. But I'm hoping we see the Phoenix Force and the X-Men books, maybe with one of these intelligences. Who knows?
Well, I want to see the fallout from the X-Men Fantastic Four miniseries, because that was the ending of that in particular showed some of the significant changes in Charles that, you know, came through because of what happened here in House of X, Powers of X.
Well, yeah. And didn't Hickman retool the FF not that long ago?
He did.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he had a really good run. They actually, I think they even came out with an omnibus or two of his run on the Fantastic Four, and I didn't pick them up, so I'm hoping they reprint them. So.
It's good stuff.
I've thought about going back to it. It's interesting. Most of the reviews I've seen are it's really, really good if you get to the end, but the first quarter you're just going to be lost for, which is a year and a half or more worth of publications. And I'm like, I'm not sure I want to slog through that.
I thought his runs on Fantastic Four and Avengers were good. I think there have been other better runs of both titles. And likewise, I like what he's doing here on X-Men, but I'd also say there have been better X-Men runs.
Well, that is such an impossible standard to live up to.
Oh, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, there's only going to be a couple of runs of any title that are there at the top, and that's going to differ for everybody.
I agree.
But it would be hard to not put the Claremont run as one of the pivotal runs of the X-Men, you know, for all time. Not to say it's necessarily the best, and there have been other great ones as well.
But I think for at least my generation and John, yours, and James, I'm not exactly sure how old you are, so possibly yours, Claremont was the X-Men.
He was.
And it's going to be hard for anybody. And I actually think Hickman made the right choice, kind of going vastly different.
Mm-hmm.
Because
absolutely.
You can't do the same thing and expect to be better. You just be compared to it's not the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would agree. Claremont, what he did is he made a lot of the drama that happened that I think we liked as teens growing up. You know, that drama between the characters. We don't see that as much here in the Hickman stuff. What we're seeing is grand planning and a big master plan, and he's trying to create an epic.
Yeah.
Very different things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and with a property that's been around as long as the X-Men, where, you know, you're going to be going up against, you know, the original creative team, you know, the Claremont era, the Morrison era, and just tons of other ones throughout, you're right. If you go down the same path that's been gone before, can you really stand out? Whereas I think one of the things that's going to stand the test of time well about this stuff is just how major the status quo changes with House of X, Powers of X.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's massive.
A few weeks ago, we did Giant Size. And again, that was such a massive shift. And as you just mentioned, Morrison, you know, and I think everybody kind of has whatever era they probably like the most. I know the Morrison era is very popular. That's where I dropped out because it was different than what I had been accustomed to. This I've come back to, I'm enjoying, but acknowledge it's very different.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, you've got to expect over the decades, as creators change, as the characters change, as the times change, you're going to wind up with fairly, you know, radically different takes and stuff. But as big of a change as Giant Size X-Men was at the time, I would be hard-pressed to name anything in the last, you know, few decades that's been as major of a change to the X-Men franchise as this with House of X, Powers of X.
I would agree with you on that. This was pretty massive. This was, you know, even bigger than when, you know, Bendis did the New Avengers or anything like that. This took the X-Men out of a malaise where they had been, where a road to nowhere, reinvigorated the franchise, changed the central character, Charles Xavier, changed the purpose of mutants, and almost deified them, which I thought was kind of cool.
Now, one thing was set up here, and I'm curious how you guys think this will eventually play out if it does. In number 5 of Power of X, Charles is inviting all the mutants to Krakoa.
Yeah.
Including Namor.
Yeah, that was interesting.
Who very much, it's like, when you're ready, we'll talk. You know, and had a very Namor-ish response to the invite. Do you think that's going to go anywhere?
I'll let you go first, Sam. What do you think?
I don't have a strong... It probably will. Namor, that is one of those things Marvel has played so... When an X-Men writer needs Namor, oh my god, he was the first mutant. When they don't want to deal with him, he's just... He's Namor. He's not a mutant at all. So, anytime I see Namor in an X-Men book, I'm always like, okay, how are they going to treat him and how seriously are they going to take him as a mutant this time?
Yeah, yeah.
That's how I felt, too, because I almost felt like that was a breaking point where they almost took the character and they said, okay, he's going to exclude himself from this group, and he's not going to include himself with them. So even though he's a mutant, technically, he's going to be doing his own thing, and he will not be included in the story going forward.
Do you guys think they should treat him as a mutant? I mean, Marvel, not the characters.
I personally don't. I never saw him as a mutant growing up.
I'm with you, James. Namor's Namor.
Yeah.
Him and Reed and Susie and that whole thing has always felt more of his place. Obviously, it's a bad spot because he's the guy who's not Doom, so he doesn't exactly fit there either. There's things I love about Namor. Arguably one of the true, timely, Golden Age heroes. Mm-hmm. Or characters, at least. But they never seem to be able to figure out exactly where to put him in kind of modern Marvel. And when I say Marvel, I'm just talking Silver Age flowing.
Yeah, yeah.
I agree with you. That's true. It seems like it's a difficult... They don't know where to put him. They don't know where he fits in.
Well, and it felt kind of forced when they had originally declared he's a mutant, so he's going to hang with the X-Men.
Yeah.
It didn't work for me at the time.
Yeah, him ruling over a nation and being an Atlantean and ruling the people of the sea, it's just like he's so separate. He's a king, you know, and a king doesn't join this other group, you know. He's used to being a leader, a ruler. So I see him as so different, like he doesn't belong there.
Well, he definitely falls in the does not play well with others category.
Yeah, he definitely.
which is why, again, I love those Fantastic Four Namor, those Reed Namor stories so much. But again, ultimately, yeah, he's Dr. Doom Light, who's got kind of all those same attributes James just mentioned.
Yeah, and I really like him because of that, because I like Dr. Doom too. You know, I don't see him as pure evil. You know, they're not a good guy, but they're a king. You know, they have good and bad to them.
It would be interesting if Dr. Doom, you know, strolled up to one of those Krakoan gates, walked through it. Yes, I've always been a mutant. I just never made a big deal about it.
That'd be hilarious.
I don't know how it would play out after that, but it would be interesting.
Yeah.
Has Marvel ever played with that? Have Latveria and Atlantis ever gone to war?
Oh, yeah. I think a few times. I could be wrong on that, but I
don't remember any good ones. It seems like there's a big crossover story there someplace.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, there was a little play in one of the X books with Franklin, too, from the Fantastic Four.
That was the Fantastic Four X-Men miniseries I was talking about that I'd like to see the ramifications of.
My bad. I'm sorry. Forgot you mentioned it.
No, not a problem.
Is the Ultimate Franklin and Reed still out there, too?
I don't know. Are they?
The... Ultimate Reed is going
he
by
was.
The Maker, and he was out there. I've lost track of him. I don't think he's...
He's disappeared.
Yeah, I think he's still available to get used.
Because...
And last time I think we saw him was in... was it... Not the Power Pack miniseries, but where... What was the miniseries that had... Future Foundation or whatever that had Julie Powers and a few of the others? Because I think he was last used
there.
Oh,
I know what you're talking about. I can't remember the name of it, though. For the life.
It might have been a Future Foundation miniseries.
And I can't tell if it's the headpiece or him and the new Charles are very similar.
That's what I kept thinking, too. They made Charles look just like... Yeah. It's bizarre.
It's but funny it's not just the look.
When I see Charles with that headset thing, I think Cyclops for some reason.
Huh.
And I think it's just the X kind of thing on the visor. But the full time with the Cerebro kind of a thing is not a look I like for Charles.
No.
Yeah. But
definitely,
but again,
not good.
Some of my personality qualms with the current Charles, he reminds me of basically the Maker from Secret Wars.
I agree.
I can see that. I can see that. It's funny because when they brought when the Maker was getting used, the alternate Reed Richards, they also brought back the Ricky Barnes Nomad or whatever from, or Bucky from Heroes Reborn.
Yep.
And I don't remember if they brought any of those other characters back, but it would be interesting to see an other timeline, other, you know, multiversal mutant try to claim residence on Krakoa, and would they be accepted if they're not native to this reality?
That would be interesting.
So they've definitely got some stuff they can play with.
And I still don't think they've addressed why Kitty couldn't get through the Krakoa gates. At
least
nothing
not.
I've read. So that's still something I want to know.
Is that still current or just through this series?
She's never been able to use one since, and Occasionally they'll drop a reference as to that's why she's on the ship and has to sail into port versus just walk onto the island. But They don't make a huge deal of it anymore. So I'm thinking, again, that's set up for the eventual endgame.
That's what I'm thinking, too. It's going to be a big part where she's going to get left behind.
I don't think she's going to get left behind. I think it may somehow save the X-Men.
You think so?
I don't know how.
Interesting.
It's either Krakoa is punishing her, or Krakoa is keeping her safe somehow.
Protecting her.
Or protecting itself.
I'm going to go with Krakoa protecting Kitty as a side effect of Cypher being his interpreter.
Okay.
Interesting.
Because as I recall, Cypher and Kitty been friends since, you know, the beginning of the New Mutants era.
Yep.
Yeah. And Cypher's become a central character in this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
The only one who can talk to Krakoa.
They still have not really resolved why he had the techno arm thing at the beginning.
Yeah.
What all was up with that.
Yeah, we still don't know. Maybe we'll get to it. Who knows?
I'm sure we'll get to it eventually, but there is an aspect where we're, 17, 18 issues into many of these titles, and there are many of these titles. So they have had time to deal with all of this stuff had they wanted to.
It's true. We've even had some go away, like the Fallen Angels. It's like a 6-issue miniseries. And so they take titles in and out of that reading order. They give you the reading order. Not all the X-books are there, but the majority of them are. Like, basically follow these. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff that hasn't happened and hasn't been addressed. So I'm thinking Marvel's given him a long leash to write a long story.
Well, it makes sense. He's really good at doing that. It would be interesting to take those kind of things from the end of the issues where it's a, here's the reading order for the next month or two, and kind of build that up from House of X, Powers of X on.
That'd be cool.
Just, you know, here's where these rotated in, here's where these rotated out, and here's the reading order they expected us to do it in.
Yeah, that'd be cool. But I'll tell you what, I think it's been organized pretty well. I think, or fantastically, I think Hickman is a genius when it comes to basically laying out a game plan and orchestrating this with the teams of people. Even though the books aren't, you can tell they're written by different writers. When he needs them, they're in the place he needs them to be. So he's a master organizer. That's definitely his talent. He's a good storyteller too. So I think I'm surprised that he didn't go to DC. And I think maybe when he wraps this up, maybe he will do something for DC if DC wants him, because he's done almost everything he can do at Marvel now.
I'm curious who his editor has been for this Fantastic Four and the Avengers stuff he's done, because in addition to being a really good organizer, and I agree with you entirely on that, he's a really good team player.
Yeah.
Because he's able to get all of these other people to, you know, tell the stories they want to tell, but play within kind of the confines of what his big arc needs. And I'm curious how much of that is Hickman, how much of that is the editors. And if he were to go, say, over to DC, would he be able to pull off that kind of a thing?
Yeah, that'd be interesting to see. Because he does get along with everyone. If it's his personality, if he's able to do a lot of these things, you know, I could see him being an editor-in-chief one day, doing something like that, just the organization, the skill that he has. But
Or chief creative officer.
Chief Creative Officer. That's even better. But he's a talented guy.
We don't need him trafficking the books. We need him coordinating them because he's
Except
doing a great job.
Nobody knows that job's been held once, and nobody's exactly sure what happened or how it worked.
They've had different people as Chief Creative Officer at multiple companies.
Yeah, and none of them have. I'm saying, name a good one.
Okay, fair enough. I was going to say Geoff Johns, but I think there's arguments on both sides of that one.
Yeah, I mean, arguably the best one was Mark Waid when he was at Boom, but that's just because he wrote his own books and nothing else connected to them.
I think to get somebody who's a really good Chief Creative Officer, you really need to go before that title existed to some of the really good editors and editor-in-chiefs at the various companies.
The Len Weins, the Jim Shooters, those guys.
The Julie Schwartz, the Mark Ruhmold.
Yep.
There have been a number of people that were really good at coordinating kind of their editorial office, or in some cases an entire line. But even one or two of the ones you put out there, like Jim Shooter, there's some people who it's like, oh, I'd never work for him again kind of thing.
Yep.
So I think you got to have people that have a really good vision for where the properties should go, and not people that are indulgent in that vision, because these are corporate properties. And I think what's great about what Hickman's doing here is not only is he telling a really fun, long story, but he's doing it in a way that is enhancing the value of the X-Men property in the meanwhile. And I don't see anything he's doing that at the moment seems like it's doing any kind of long-term damage, because, well, you know, they're going to have to undo this later, as was the case in certain other revamps of other properties elsewhere.
I would agree. And I don't know if that's attributed to the editors and working with him, or if it's him himself, but there's definitely something right that happens when he's been writing these big, you know, revamps, whether it be when he did the Avengers, not necessarily a revamp, but his story that he did there, the Fantastic Four, or whatever it is that he's working on at the time.
That said, have they been that successful? And the only reason I ask that is I know there's a group of people who love his Fantastic Four work, but I've heard nothing about the Fantastic Four from the time he left until more recently. I believe Dan Slott's on the book now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people seem to be enjoying that, but not necessarily that it's building off Hickman stuff. Maybe it is. And again, the Avengers Infinity people really, really liked it, but I think they were kind of a minority. And again, I'm not sure anything is. The Avengers have not been great since then.
Well, I think what makes Hickman's work stand out is not only is it a good read, but for me at least, there's a sense of something bigger going on. It's not just, hey, I've got this cool six-issue story I'm going to tell, and then I'm going to tell another cool six-issue story, and then another one. It's like, this is a fully realized world. There's a lot going on, and we're kind of peeling the onion to learn more and more about it and seeing more and more. And not every take is going to work for everybody, and that's fine. But I do think what he's doing here is better than what it is had replaced by just orders of magnitude. And what it replaced was, it was okay. It wasn't bad, but there wasn't the sense of it's going somewhere.
And like I said, I do think one of the things in his favor in this case is the fact that you do have other writers working on other properties currently, and everybody still seems to be liking a lot of them. Again, Fantastic Four, it felt like people that liked the Fantastic Four and liked Hickman's run loved it, but the second he left, they left. And the ones that didn't like it left early on in his run. And kind of same thing with the Avengers, to some degree.
Well, I think you're always going to have a contingent of people who say they like the property but are really following a creator.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
And there's a lot of, I think, fair weather fans and stuff. And there's nothing wrong with that. If there's a take on a book and you're enjoying it, read it. If that take stops and you don't want to bother sampling or you don't like what's after it, skip it. That's fine. But to then say, oh, I'm a hardcore fan of X, Y, or Z, well, how long have you really been reading it? You know, I can consider myself a long-term fan of the X-Men because I've been reading it since the 80s, through the ups and the downs.
A long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not everybody can or wants to do that, and that's fine. But I always do find it humorous when somebody says, oh, yeah, I'm a big fan of this. And, well, what'd you think of this? Oh, I didn't read that creator on it. I don't like that creator. Well, how about this one? I didn't read that one either. Yeah. I actually had a former coworker who was introduced to me as being a big comic fan. Turns out he didn't read comics. He watched the Marvel movies.
That made him a big comic fan.
I'm like, okay, interesting.
Yeah, I tell people I record, I'm a co-host on a podcast for comic books, and they automatically assume I'm talking about movies. It's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm.
Well, because as popular as, let's say, House of X, Powers of X is, it's a drop in the bucket compared to the number of people who've seen any or all of the X-Men movies.
Yeah, Avengers Endgame, whatever. You name it.
Familiar with the X-Men cartoon from the 90s.
Yeah.
You know.
It's very true.
There came a point, and I don't know exactly when, where comics stopped kind of owning their own properties the way they did, and the derivative stories on TV, film, video game, whatever, became what was culturally accepted as, I don't say the continuity, but as the controlling force.
Very true.
Yeah, but I think that's always true if you have something that's a big enough hit. You talk to people a little older than us, John. The Adam West Batman television show was Batman to an entire generation. And read some of those goofy Silver Age stories. It clearly had an effect on the comics, too.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, I mean, arguably it's all the way until 400 before it really changes significantly, arguably more like 360. But
I guess, in my mind, the difference is back at the height of Batmania, back with the TV show and stuff, I don't think there was the follow-up comment of, oh, they still do comics? That there is kind of now.
Yeah, but that's a general reading thing, I think.
That's true. That's true. And I think it's a matter of comics having gone off the mass market to the direct market. The cost of comics, instead of being 35 cents, they're $3.99 or more. I mean, there's tons of reasons. But I guess for me, part of the question is, at what point do we see, say, this take on the X-Men showing up on TV, in the movies, or something of that sort?
Yeah, that I'm not sure. It's possible, but who knows?
I mean, hell, it'd be an interesting way to introduce the X-Men and the mutants and stuff to the MCU.
You could use the Moira hook, basically, to introduce them and put them in there with the Avengers and whatever else you want to put them in there with.
Well, you just start with, you know, I'm Charles Xavier, I had a dream, but it's gone. Here, you know, you woke up, reality changed on you.
That would be an awesome way to do it.
You could literally start with that speech and cut to the various MCU heroes of, what the hell, you know?
For those of us that are 3 weeks into WandaVision, there's still a chance that happens to some degree here.
I have not watched any of that yet, so I'm going to marathon that when it's done. I'm looking forward to it, though. But yeah, I think obviously Scarlet Witch is an easy way to introduce mutants into the MCU proper. Anyways, I think this is something that was really well done and is something that we're going to see get leveraged in some way, shape, or form in the secondary, you know, form of TV and movies and such, because it's too good not to.
It's too good, and I think when they brought Hickman in, we need someone to script something where we can bring these into the MCU. You know, they've been at Fox, and they've been mismanaged. I'm not saying anything bad about the Fox movies, but we want to reintroduce them, and I think that's what this was written for.
Well, I think the big test of Marvel's editorial department is going to be when Hickman's run ends, and it's going to end at some point,
mm-hmm.
Who follows him up?
That's going to be massive.
It's going to be a tough act to follow.
Yeah, I agree. That's a key point. I'm not as creator-centric as you and many fans. I don't care who it is. Whoever it is needs to be able to continue, and that, I think, is the hard part.
That's fair. I care less who it is than what take of the X-Men follows this. And do they continue what's going on here, or is it again kind of a reset and what happens on the next take?
Yeah.
And to me, and I know you're enjoying his Thor run, to me, that is where, of the modern guys I'm reading, Donny Cates is so good. Jonathan Hickman may be great, but he kind of has to do these clean slates for his stories.
Yeah.
Donny Cates somehow just takes over and makes everything work.
Yeah.
without having to reboot everything.
He's and insanely good.
Would be an interesting kind of personality to have replace somebody like Hickman. Yeah.
Yeah. I would love that.
He's one of the few writers I can think of that really, in modern times, is able to do that. Not go, oh, start all over because this is me now. No, this is still whatever. Venom, Thor. We're just going to keep continuing their story.
Continue the story and make it more exciting.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I guess the question is, when this run ends, is it going to be that kind of a clean break and a restart, or is it going to be a smooth transition between creative teams, much like when Bendis got off Daredevil, I think it was, where that was a nice smooth transition.
But I'm hoping we don't see the end of it for a while because I'm enjoying myself.
I don't see any reason for it to end anytime soon. Yeah, I agree.
Hopefully that's true.
I'd like to see them kind of cycle through a lot of the other mutant teams and properties and titles from years gone by, just to see what the take under this, you know, status quo would be.
Yeah.
So, good stuff. Fun read.
I agree.
I was a little frustrated that there were a couple of things revealed in Powers of X that were really integral to House of X. So the two are tightly intertwined. So if you haven't read them, I do recommend getting that hardcover and reading them in that order.
Yeah, it'll make the story make way more sense.
And if you're on Marvel Unlimited, read House of X number one first, and then the reading order is the last page of every comic in the series. So it'll tell you exactly which one to go to next.
I think that in and of itself was a really smart move because it gave kind of a an exit plan for every issue.
Yeah, and for people who are digital readers, Marvel Unlimited, it makes it very easy for them not to trying to have to figure out which comic came out first. Just look at the checklist.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's a little frustrating that when you hit next in series, it doesn't go to the next on the reading list. But as long as you look at the reading list, it's very easy to know what the next one is.
Yeah. Man, if I were doing the app for that, I would have tried to get those pages to where they were clickable links.
Yeah, that would have been cool.
So, anything else on this?
Nah, I had fun, but thanks, guys.
Yeah,
it was good to have both of you guys on at once.
Yeah, cool.
With that, we'll call it an episode.
The March previews came out on February 24th, and the deadline for preview spotlight number 160 is the morning of Saturday, March 6th. Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website. And a quick reminder that we've also got the recommendation roundtable episodes going. The point of those episodes is to help people find other ways to spend their time. So send in pics of comic books, either older ones, back issues, trades, whatever, novels, television shows, movies, video games, if there's a board game you think people might really enjoy or something. Let's get that out there. We've got a lot of ways we can spend our time in helping people find things that they might be interested in. It's just a great thing to do. I've gotten a lot of clips from Billy Hogan. I want to thank him for that. It reminded me that I should really go reread Astro City and put a few other things kind of back on my radar, including a couple of novels he recommended. I've added those to my reading list. We'll see when I get to them. But we've got no deadline for these episodes. The way these episodes work is you send in one clip per pick, and that could be a particular book or video game or TV show, or it could be a series of books, anything that's kind of a unified thing. And when I get enough of those clips, I'll string them together, I'll kick out an episode. So that means if I get tons of clips, like when Billy sent me about, I don't know, an hour and 45 minutes of some great clips, that was enough for me to get two episodes put together, about an hour for one and about 45 minutes or so for the other. So that's what episodes 2 and 3 are. But if I don't get clips, it may be a while before that next episode comes out. And the reason I'm doing this is there are a lot of things hitting like the streaming services and stuff like that on not really a set cadence like we've got for the preview spotlight. So if you wake up one morning and say, you know what, there's a bunch of stuff I think people might enjoy, spend a few minutes, send in the clips, they get in the queue. And if it's another few months before you do the next one, that's great. But hopefully we have enough people sending in clips on a regular enough basis that we can be putting one of these episodes out every month, every other month, or something like that. So
once again, the point here is just to recommend older comic books, novels, television shows, movies, video games, or anything else that doesn't really fit the format of the preview spotlight, but that you really want to kind of share your love of and encourage other people to check out. So once again, there's no deadline on those recommendation roundtable clips. It's an open invitation for everybody at all times. So please send in clips when you've got something you're thinking about and share the love.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.